in which limbo we whirled, clutching the straws of our definitions. The end quotes protest novel, so far from being disturbing, is an accepted and comforting aspect of the American scene, ramifying that framework we believe to be so necessary. Whatever unsettling questions are raised are evanescent, titillating, remote, for this has nothing to do with us. It is safely ensconced in the social arena, where indeed it has nothing to do with anyone, so that finally we receive a very definite thrill of virtue from the fact that we are reading such a book at all. This report from the pit reassures us of its reality and its darkness and of our own salvation. And as long as such books are being published, an American liberal once said to me, everything will be all right. That's much to think about, isn't it? Scott?
All right, thanks, Tom. It's kind of hard to follow not only Tom, but also James Baldwin, so we'll see what I can do. All right, well, it's, first I have to say, I'll begin this on the side, that I'm a bit of a sentimentalist, when I read the book the first time, I got a little teary-eyed in a couple of the sections, and it's good to be able to read the text and then be able to come back to it later on with a little bit more of a critical lens. I saw Paddington 2 yesterday, and at the end of Paddington 2, I got a little teary-eyed, too. So if I can get a little teary-eyed at Paddington, then certainly the horrors of slavery will also bring some tears to the eyes. It's fitting to have this talk today, though. It's 1 week after New Year's Day. I don't know if you know it or not, but January 1st is the anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. I should mention, too, I'm wearing a tie. This is my Emancipation Proclamation tie. Lauren gave me this for Christmas 1 year. I actually have Harriet Tubman socks, too. So you can see it here for sure to mark the $20 bill if they allow that to happen. Now, while an imperfect document, the Emancipation Proclamation, which arguably freed nobody upon its enactment, the Emancipation Proclamation did symbolize a major achievement for the abolitionist movement. Less than 30 years prior, Elijah Lovejoy, whose name is attached to our plaque honoring the doctors killed by anti-abortion terrorists, was himself killed by a racist terrorist for advocating what Abraham Lincoln's signature made law. With the stroke of a pen, a series of events were set in motion that officially made the Civil War about slavery, and particularly ending slavery. How this moment came to pass was through the valiant efforts of numerous people, black and white, using a multitude of tactics to end chattel slavery in the United States. One of the most effective tactics for winning the hearts and minds of white Americans was the written word. While Harriet Beecher Stowe was not the first author to advocate for the end of slavery, few abolitionists had the impact of Stowe. This is not to take away from the works of other writers, most notably Alato Equiano and Frederick Douglass, whose works are still being read to this day, nor the armed struggles, specifically the Haitian Revolution, Gabriel's Rebellion in Virginia, Nat Turner's Rebellion also in Virginia, plus the many, many other small-scale revolts that took place on many, many plantations throughout the South. Nonetheless, when Harriet Beecher Stowe began writing Uncle Tom's Cabin, it would have been hard to imagine how much of an impact this one event would have, not only in her initial goals, but in ways that few could have foreseen. As with many works of literature, the creation of Uncle Tom's Cabin was influenced by several factors. First, and most importantly, Stowe was a devout Christian and had trouble seeing slave owners as acting within any Christian frame. She also read the narrative of a man formerly enslaved named Josiah Henson, as well as numerous other primary source narratives, to give her a feeling of what slavery was like. Another factor that played into her writing her text was the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. Now, if abolitionist movement needed gas to get it moving, the Fugitive Slave Act was like rocket fuel. Prior to the act, enslaved Africans in the South could escape to a free state in the North, and they had a strong chance of remaining free. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 changed this by requiring those citizens in free states to act as deputies for slaveholders in the South. It's also important to keep in mind, shortly before she wrote her novel, Stowe lost a beloved daughter. When her young daughter died, Stowe learned for the first time what it was like to lose a child and transferred that empathy to the plight of an enslaved mother having her children sold. While there were likely many other reasons which propelled Stowe to write her novel, these ultimately pushed her abolitionism from theory into practice. Now, for those who haven't read Uncle Tom's Cabin, and just out of curiosity, how many of you have read Uncle Tom's Cabin? All right, so a lot of you. Okay, so a lot of people have read it. Now, I'll do a little exercise here, too, in the middle. How many of you have read or seen Gone with the Wind? All right, now let me see another one. How many of you have seen either the whole movie or clips, Birth of a Nation, 1915, Birth of a Nation? All right, how many of you have seen the recent Birth of a Nation? Okay, one. All right, so we got a little bit of a framework to work with, and I'll come back to that in a second. All right, now for those who haven't read Uncle Tom's Cabin, there are a few different plot lines, or just to refresh your memories, a few different plot lines taking place. The story starts off on a plantation where an older enslaved African lives, along with numerous others. His name is Uncle Tom. The man who legally owns Uncle Tom falls into debt and needs to raise money quickly, although the slave owner is portrayed as a good master. And I always put that in quotes, too, because this kind of hints at the argument itself, but a good master. He claims to have no choice but to sell some of the slaves on his plantation. He decides to sell Tom and the young son of a housemaid, a very light-skinned biracial woman named Eliza. Tom is the patriarch within the enslaved community on this plantation, and although he's married and has a family, he agrees not to resist his sale. His rationale is that if he resists, everyone else will be sold. So he allows himself to be sold to protect the rest of the enslaved population. Uncle Tom sacrifices himself like Christ, you know, going back to Stowe's religious beliefs, sacrifice himself like Christ so others could live. Eliza, on the other hand, will not have her child sold and escapes in one of the most famous scenes in literary history, Eliza crossing the Ohio River. And I'm going to show you this right here. This is from the 1903 version. This is actually a Thomas Edison film, too. And it's kind of neat because you can see the how a lot of people actually would have come to the story. That's Eliza escaping, jumping out the window. Now, this version doesn't actually play completely to the book, but most of the plays also didn't. Now she's crossing over the Ohio. You can see how difficult this would be. Gets really scary in a second. Yep. I imagine somebody's on the other side with some dog food. Those are the slave hunters trying to catch her. There's Eliza. How could they possibly catch her? She's free. All right. All right, that's good. It's so neat to be able to see some of these old films just because everybody, as I mentioned to all of us in the back, everybody in that film was dead before I was even born. To me, it's just fascinating. It's like this time machine. So anyway, that's one of the most famous scenes in literary history. Tom is initially sold to another good master, a man named St. Clair, who knows slavery is wrong but still owns people. While with this master, Tom becomes a father figure to a young girl named Ava, who teaches everyone, including an enslaved African girl named Topsy, true Christian values of love and charity. Ava's death convinces St. Clair to free Tom, but he's killed in a fight right before he was about to free him, and Tom is once again sold, this time to one of literature's great villains, Simon Legree, a Frenchman. Not to give away the ending, spoiler alert, so if you're going to read it and you haven't, let me tell you, okay, Legree is cruel and ultimately beats the old man, Uncle Tom, to death. Meanwhile, Eliza and her husband and child successfully crossed, as you saw, into the north and eventually made their way to Canada. And at the end of the book, made their plans to resettle in the African nation of Liberia, which, as I'm sure that you know, was founded by former African Americans as a potential new homeland. When Stowe first published her book, it was an immediate bestseller. Sales skyrocketed in the North and overseas, but the book was not surprisingly banned down here. Despite the ban in the South, apparently enough people read or heard about the content of Uncle Tom's Cabin and immediately started publishing their own anti-Tom novels. The worry was that Stowe's depictions of white Southerners was a gross mischaracterization of the slaveholding class. Much of their mythology rested upon the idea of paternalism. The plantation owners were loving fathers who, on rare occasion, spanked a child for misbehavior, but was never cruel. Stowe's novel depicted the owners in a different light. Good masters could be nice, but capitalism was such that owning human property made it possible when times were tough. Human beings, by far the greatest moneymaker in the South, could be sold if necessary to save the livelihood of the slave-owning class. An enslaved African could have a very benevolent owner, but if the slave owner was prone to gambling or drink, all could be lost, including your children. One didn't need a cruel master, as it was somewhat likely that most enslaved Africans would eventually be sold. And whether or not one went to a cruel master was irrelevant, as the institution itself was cruel and always put the individual or family in danger at all times. Despite critiquing the institution and the occasional Simon Legree, Stowe's book doesn't dig deeper, as James Baldwin pointed out, into the white psyche, which allowed for this to happen in the first place. The devaluation of human life and even the very need to write a book to get white people, North and South, to have sympathy for other people that don't look like them. Southern slaveholders didn't like this portrayal of their lives because it made many feel as if they were participating in an evil institution, because they were. White Northerners, however, were hardly free of racism, as is depicted in the book on numerous occasions. Many opposed slavery, but still held very white supremacist views of Africans. And we can stretch that further onto Stowe, because her ultimate solution for Eliza is to send her back to Africa, which was also one of Lincoln's ideas and many other people in the abolitionist movement's ideas was that blacks and whites couldn't get along after slavery and they'd have to leave the country. So that's a whole other talk. But that's part of the story, too. In fact, that's how she ends the story. Most, if not all, slave narratives were written for and published by white people with the express interest of abolishing slavery. Ending racism was different, though. 150 years after the Civil War, in some ways it seems that we've progressed very little, in part because of willingness among people to take risks. In some ways, this is what makes Stowe's novel unique. She risked quite a bit to speak out on a large scale on this issue. And as literature goes, few, if any, books in the 19th century, as Tom had pointed out, had as much of an impact as hers did. If we were to trust the apocryphal story about Stowe's 1862 meeting with Abraham Lincoln, where the president was said to have joked, "So you're the little woman who started this great war," then Uncle Tom's Cabin is definitely an example of an impactful book. Now, whether people read the book or saw one of the multitude of Tom plays, like the one that you just saw, created after the book's release, white Americans were often for the first time finding themselves sympathizing with the enslaved. For this, Stowe did something few other writers were able to do prior, which is get whites to see non-whites as humans. As I mentioned, after the book was released, Stowe was immediately met with heavy criticism. As Southern white writers wrote their own versions of Uncle Tom, their Tom and his fellow Africans were treated like family in Christian households. Others tried to tear apart Stowe's book on a factual basis, saying the entire book was made up of lies, fake news of the era. To bolster her book, Stowe released another book the following year that she called A Key to Uncle Tom's Cabin, like a key, like you're opening the door to look into the cabin. The Key was a book of her sources. She mentioned Josiah Henson, who I mentioned before, as a main source, much to Henson's pleasure, as he referred to himself as the real Uncle Tom for the rest of his life. She also included various excerpts from other narratives and several news clippings to show the fictional events in her story were only barely fiction. Included in the news articles was one about a former resident of New York State who was kidnapped and sold into slavery, but eventually found freedom over a decade later. That man, at great personal pain, went on to write his own book, adding to the growing body of anti-slave narratives, but also supporting Harriet Beecher Stowe's claims. His name was Solomon Northup, and the book he wrote was 12 Years a Slave. While Henson's narrative could have been seen as the inspiration for Uncle Tom's Cabin, Northup's 12 Years a Slave was the validation. From the first page, where Northup dedicates the book to Harriet Beecher Stowe and calls his narrative another key to Uncle Tom's Cabin, to his continual references to Uncle Tom's Cabin throughout the text, anyone who knows Stowe's book and reads Northup's will see that they are very closely connected. One aspect I like to point out is with one of the main characters in Stowe's book, Eliza, as Northup's literary counterpart, also named Eliza. Stowe's Eliza, there's an Eliza in Uncle Tom's Cabin, of course, and there's an Eliza in 12 Years a Slave. Stowe's Eliza in Uncle Tom's Cabin escapes with her child and finds happiness outside of slavery and eventually in Africa, something only a few thousand African Americans were able to do, but many anti-slavery societies and abolitionists desired, but nonetheless. Northup's Eliza is, unfortunately, a more realistic depiction. She is initially living a life of a kept woman, has children with the good master, and when he dies, she is sold along with her children. She witnesses her son and her daughter sold in front of her, including her very young daughter, who is to be sold into brothels in New Orleans. The pain is too much for Northup's Eliza, and she never recovers from the trauma and dies, knowing she cannot protect her children. Northup even claims death would be better for her children, knowing what life would likely endure under slavery's evil yoke. Now, to be honest, we don't know if Northup's characters are fictionalized names or not, and it's certainly possible Northup uses Eliza's name to show what likely would have happened to a real-life Eliza. But at any rate, whereas Stowe's Eliza is one of a fictional hope, Northup's Eliza is the exact opposite. Yet, it's through Stowe's book that we're allowed to see Northup. This is not to take away from Northup's work, by any means. To me, Northup's work is better written, especially for modern audiences. And if you teach these two books together, I promise you, you know, the kids are going to be much more interested in 12 Years a Slave than they will the very, very long Harriet Stowe's book, Harriet Beecher Stowe's book. His writing is powerful and rarely dry. If it were a novel, I think James Baldwin would have very positive things to say about the literary quality of 12 Years, which incidentally was nearly lost completely to history, but that's a whole other story. Nonetheless, one of the many things that makes Stowe's work problematic is the blatant racism within the text. While this can be excused to some extent by the time she wrote, as well as her experience as a white woman, the truth is that there is no way a white woman living in the 19th century could truly understand what an African enslaved in the South endured, despite her connections with the loss of her child. While Stowe's book is melodramatic and reads as very heavy-handed propaganda, and if you think that's too harsh, go back to your copy and read it, and all these little dear reader sections at the end of nearly every other chapter. Dear reader, how could you as a Christian do this? Dear reader, how could you do? Every other chapter has this long thing. It's like, all right, we get it here. Not to mention the perpetuation of stereotypes that Stowe used in the which allowed for the unfortunate Uncle Tom figure to come about in our modern vocabulary, which is one of the book's most lasting legacies, and will likely make the book eternally cringeworthy to teach in many classes. Much more, now I've had this problem too, teaching the class too, be like, all right, okay, we'll talk about this, but nonetheless. Much more people know the term Uncle Tom than have read the book. Critic David Reynolds discussed this modern depiction in his book, and I got a copy of it here. It's Mightier Than the Sword, as being very inaccurate and an inaccurate depiction of the character and a severe misreading. This is somewhat true. Stowe's Tom is hardly a weak figure, but was one willing to sacrifice his life for the people. He points to a great many powerful figures in African-American history who admired the character of Uncle Tom, Frederick Douglass, who had critiques of the novel, and so was also so enamored with the character that he chose to act as Uncle Tom during an American exhibition at one of the World's Fairs. Langston Hughes was also an admirer of Harry Beecher Stowe in Uncle Tom's Cabin, in the novel itself. And Paul Robeson, one of my all-time heroes, even was set to perform as Uncle Tom in a never-released film version of the book. And I think they didn't release the book or the film because they decided, all right, the tide has changed on this story. Nonetheless, that's toothpaste that won't go back into the tube very easily. And if it's a if that's a misreading of Uncle Tom, it's one that we'll just have to live with. Besides the legacy of the characterization of Uncle Tom, the book's history also has several interesting spinoffs. Besides 12 Years a Slave, another one of the another on the other side, the anti-Tom side, was written by a Southern author named Thomas Dixon. After seeing one of the so-called Tom plays, like the one you saw, he was so incensed by this depiction of white Southern people in the novel that he immediately set to write his own novel as a correction to Stowe's book. His reaction to Uncle Tom's Cabin was a series of books, most notably one named The Klansman, which glorified the Ku Klux Klan. Dixon's book was eventually adapted into the film by the director D.W. Griffith and became one of the first feature-length films, The Incredibly Racist Birth of a Nation, which almost single-handedly revived the almost extinct Ku Klux Klan and began a century of violence that we're still in the midst of today. You know, think of Charlottesville. On the other hand, D.W. Griffith's film created its own backlash. The somewhat new NAACP was so infuriated with this film that it was garnering the attention that it received, even in the White House, that the Civil Rights Organization began protesting theaters showing Birth of a Nation and gained incredible exposure, catapulting the Civil Rights Organization, the NAACP, into the one that we know of today. Furthermore, a young African-American director named Oscar Michaud, who, if you're not familiar with him, his films are on Netflix and are really worth checking out, created his own answer to Griffith's film, Within Our Gates, which is now seen as the first feature-length African-American film. Still, other Hollywood directors tried multiple times to use the new medium of the film to retell Uncle Tom's Cabin. A 1927 version, by far one of the best silent versions of the film, was another response to Griffith's Birth of a Nation, trying to correct the story. These are just three responses to Birth of a Nation, which was the response to Uncle Tom's Cabin. Yet this last film was so angered, the last version of Uncle Tom's Cabin, so angered one white Southern writer that she went home from the theater and penned her own correction. Her name was Margaret Mitchell, and her book, which later became the movie, was Gone with the Wind, which is often seen as home base for the Lost Cause mythology, upheld by the Confederate sympathizers. While the Lost Cause still has some staying power, as we see with all the Confederate statues and all the debates around that, Uncle Tom's Cabin's unintended anti-racist legacy also has its own continued legacy, that Solomon Northup's 12 Years a Slave became a film and introduced a new conversation about America's history with race and slavery at the height of the Black Lives Matter movement speaks volumes to the reach of Uncle Tom's Cabin. And I can also bring in the new version of Birth of a Nation, too, is a continuation of that legacy. So is this book problematic? Absolutely. This book is definitely problematic. But did it have an impact on the way we see slavery and race? To that, there is no doubt. Even Malcolm X said that Uncle Tom's Cabin allowed him to understand what it was like to be enslaved. If the story about Lincoln and Stowe is really true, that she was indeed the little woman who started this great war, and this being a war that eventually brought about the Emancipation Proclamation, as reference to my tie, which led to the enlistment of black soldiers into the U.S. Army and helped end the war and ultimately end slavery, then I do think it's safe to offer some praise up to Harriet Beecher Stowe, like Frederick Douglass did and Solomon Northup did. She's certainly worthy of criticism. Of that, there is no doubt. But considering we're currently still living in a world, for better or worse, shaped by her book, there is also no doubt. Therefore, it's in our best interest to know her book. But after we read it, I would also like to suggest that you read 12 Years a Slave by Solomon Northup, Harriet Jacobs' narrative, Frederick Douglass's many biographies, and you don't have to stop there. From my understanding, there's around 230-plus versions of slave narratives, some bigger, some longer, some short pieces, but there's a lot of reading out there. We don't have to be fans of her book or even like her book, but it behooves us to know it so we can get to answer Baldwin's questions. How could one group of people enslave and dehumanize another and then ignore this history in the hopes that we as a people can stand up to discrimination, fight white supremacy, and finally end racism whenever and wherever we see its ugly head rise to the surface once and for all? Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Learned so much about that. Now we have the time for the offertory. The church is financially supported solely from contributions by our members and friends. If you would like your cash donation to be recorded, please use an envelope provided with your name. So if we could have the collection now.
Song right behind us.
Yeah, right.
Feel free to sing.
John Brown's body lies a molding in the grave. John Brown's body lies a molding in the grave. John Brown's body lies a molding in the grave, and his soul goes marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah.
That's also known as what? What's the other? Battle Hymn of the Republic. I like these lyrics better. Yes, we have some announcements from Kate.
Hi. I'd like to take an opportunity first to welcome any guests there are today. And if there's any guests on this side of the church who would like to, if they feel comfortable, stand up and announce themselves, so that we can get to know you better, we'd love that. Okay. Anybody in the middle who would like to? Okay, well, everybody's looking pretty familiar, so welcome if you're here. Is there anybody on this side who'd like to stand? Awesome. Welcome, Caden. Okay, I do have a lot of announcements. I think I'm going to just invite Jack up first because his is very important, and then I'll continue with the rest.
Hey, I'm Jack Wolverton. I just wanted to make sure everybody knew about the thing after service. It's a second hour for the ministerial future transition. Thank you, Penny. So we're going to set it up in here. We'll have posters on the side of the wall that we can go through and discuss the transition, what the options are. We got Carol Trotter here that's going to help run the transition meeting, and then Penny and I are going to help her out. But this is not going to decide what the future of the church is. Obviously, most of you know that Julie's leaving after May, so we're trying to understand what our options are for the next several years, and it's just a way of getting options out on the table, try to narrow it down into something that we can kind of work with, and hopefully by another couple of meetings and by March that we'll have kind of a path forward for the church. So it's really important. We want to get everybody's thoughts. There'll be kind of a vote where everybody gets to put their thoughts and what the future will be. And then we'll take those three major subsets and kind of go forward with that to help narrow it down. So it's really important. We'd like you all to stay and join us. Thanks.
After that gathering that we have after the service today, I hope that some people are able to stay to help take down Christmas. We'll just get done as much as we can with the people who come, and if we have more to do next week, we'll do some more next week. Okay, next week we will be preparing our float for the Martin Luther King Parade. So those of you who are interested in helping decorate our trailer to make a float, that would be really great to have you help us. We always like new ideas. And if you have any Mardi Gras beads at home that are just lying in a box somewhere or in plastic bags, please bring them, because we like to recycle them, and you know, it helps the kids love to throw them, and we have a good time at the parade.